Good evening. My name is John Van Horn. I'm the director of the Library Company, and I'm delighted to see such a huge crowd here, wonderful turnout, to hear from two of our longtime friends, Don Cresswell and Chris Lane. They're well known to all of you, I'm sure. This program this evening is the inaugural program kicking off what we're calling our program in visual culture. This is a program that will be concerned with the collecting and care and cataloging and display of visual materials, and you'll be hearing more about that from our curator of prints and photographs, Sarah Weatherwax, in a few minutes. For those of you, this doesn't seem like it's on. Can you?
No, it is.
It is? Okay. Good. Oh, all right. For those of you who are not already Library Company members, let me welcome you especially and tell you that you are at an independent research library. The Library Company was founded by Benjamin Franklin more than 275 years ago. We now have a huge collection of rare books, pamphlets, broadsides, manuscripts, and graphic works dealing with all areas of American history through about the end of the 19th century. We have about 500,000 of those printed works, and then we do have on top of that our collection of prints and photographs. There were really two sources of inspiration for our program in visual culture, institutional and individual. And institutionally, I should say that among those 500,000 plus items that we have here, we have strengths in particular fields, and we like to bring attention to those to the extent we can. So about 10 years ago, we established a special program relating to early American economic history, and that now is endowed and fully functioning, and it has funding for things such as fellowships and acquisitions and public programs and exhibitions and that sort of thing. Just last year, with the support of a grant from the Albert M. Greenfield Foundation, we established a very similar program on that model of the economy program in one of our other great subject strengths, which is African American history. And that program also has funds for things like exhibitions and fellowships and public programs. The exhibition we have on view now, as a matter of fact, is related to that program in African American history, as is a major conference that we're co-sponsoring that will take place next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday called Atlantic Emancipations. So if any of you are interested in that subject, I'd recommend that you try to learn more about that as well. We have some flyers at the front desk about the conference. Now, as far as the personal inspiration, that comes in the form of one of our trustees and former board president, William H. Helfand. He's an avid collector of all kinds of things, particularly visual materials dealing with medical history and especially popular medicine. And over the last 8 years or so, he's given to us about 10,000 individual items that relate to those collecting interests of his, including trade cards, advertising pamphlets, comic valentines, various kinds of broadsides, political cartoons, that sort of thing. So he's really been a terrific supporter of this aspect of our collecting. And he wanted to see us create some kind of a program dealing with visual culture. And for several years now has been supporting an annual short-term fellowship for people who come here to work in our graphics collection. Bill Helfand, unfortunately, he lives in New York City, which is not unfortunate. But unfortunately, he couldn't be with us this evening, and I know he regrets that, but I did want to let you know just how instrumental he's been in getting this program off the ground. And then let me also mention another one of our members who is here this evening, David Durrett. He is also an avid collector of all manner of things. He's also a very generous donor of much of what he collects on our behalf. And I want to thank him for what he's done to enhance our collection of ephemera and visual materials. So thank you, David. And now let me turn to Sarah Weatherwax, our curator of prints and photographs, who has some more words for you, and then we'll introduce our speakers.
I'm thrilled to see so many people here for the inaugural event of our visual culture program. And as John Van Horn just told you, the program is designed to promote the interpretation, the care, and the collection of historic visual images. And we really want to promote the idea of using visual images as primary documents for historical research, not to think of visuals simply as illustrations to accompany your text. We also want to encourage people to think of visual materials in a very broad sense. Here at the Library Company, our visual collection ranges from important paintings such as the early view of Philadelphia over the card catalog to small pieces of ephemera such as 19th century advertising trade cards or pieces of Civil War stationery or envelopes. We also are planning to highlight different aspects of our visual collection in some upcoming exhibitions here at the Library Company. In 2009, we will be doing an exhibition about daguerreotypes in Philadelphia. And our spring 2010 exhibition will highlight Philadelphia lithographs produced during the first 50 years of commercial lithography in the city. In the slightly more immediate future, in the upcoming months, under the auspices of the Visual Culture Program, we plan to hold a series of events that will encourage people who are interested in visuals. We'll give them a forum to exchange information and reflect about historical images. And I hope to see all, or at least some of you, attend those events as well. Before I introduce the speakers, I just wanted to let all of you know the format for tonight's event. We've asked our two speakers to talk for about 5 to 10 minutes each, and then we're throwing open the event to all of you in the audience to ask questions, to make comments. Wendy Wilson, who's going to stand, she is our curator of books, and she will be wielding the microphone. Because I really do, if any of you have questions, I would ask that you just raise your hand, and Wendy will work her way over to you, or at least hand the microphone down the aisle to you. I know everyone's questions will be insightful and important, so we want to make sure that everyone hears everybody else in the audience. And also, we are doing a podcast of this evening's event, so we want to make sure that the audio is actually audible. So please try to use the microphone. Our first speaker will be Donald Cresswell. Don earned his PhD in American Studies from George Washington University. In the early years of his career, he was employed as an academic librarian and as a college professor. He came to Philadelphia to work for a print and book dealer, and while working there, met Christopher Lane. In 1982, Don and Chris founded their own business, the Philadelphia Print Shop, located in Chestnut Hill. Don frequently travels around the country lecturing about historic prints and maps. He has written extensively about historic graphics, including authoring the important reference work, The American Revolution in Drawings and Prints, a checklist of 1765 to 1790 graphics in the Library of Congress. And in 1990, along with Chris, he co-authored Prints of Philadelphia. Since 1997, Don has served as one of the expert appraisers on the PBS show The Antiques Roadshow. So he's a celebrity. We have celebrities here tonight. Our second speaker is Christopher Lane, whose academic work in philosophy was interrupted for what was supposed to be a year-long stint working for a Philadelphia print dealer. Chris soon realized that his lifelong interest in prints and maps was actually what he wanted to pursue for a career, and he and Don became partners in the Philadelphia Print Shop. Chris has authored numerous catalogs and articles about maps and prints. And I urge you, if you have not already done so, please take a look in the case in the Logan Room, which is the room where the food and drink was, just to get an idea of the variety of materials that are produced by the Philadelphia Print Shop. Chris, for the last decade, has also served as an expert appraiser for the Antiques Roadshow. Chris is currently curating an exhibition at the Frick Art and Historical Center in Pittsburgh entitled A Panorama of Pittsburgh, 19th Century Printed Views, scheduled to run from June through October of 2008. And I will let you know that there are several Library Company items that will be included in that show. So that was my shameless plug for the Library Company. And having said that, without further ado, let me turn the microphone over to Don Cresswell, our first speaker.
I suppose what you wanted me to say is, how did I get into all this? And when people say, how did you ever get interested in old prints? The first thing that pops into my mind is when I was about 4 years old, my parents received a big wooden box full of books from my grandfather in Vancouver, British Columbia. And it was a set of books called The Historian's History of the World. And it had all these photogravures in it that illustrated events in history. And I remember laying on the floor making up stories about what was going on in all these pictures. And it was the greatest impetus to learn how to read, because I always wanted to know. I used to go in the kitchen and, Mom, what does this say? You know, and she'd say, well, you know, it says da-da-da-da, but then, you know, scurry on out. And for some reason, I've just always enjoyed history. And when I went away to college, my father insisted that I do something that had to do with money, so I started as a business major. And I didn't like that. And I was inspired by the English department, but he said, no, you know, I will not pay your tuition. But I was paying half my tuition at that time, so 50% of the time was as an English major, and I double majored in English and economics. Well, I was inspired to be an English professor, like a wonderful professor I had in college, and I went off to the University of Cincinnati planning to be an English professor. But when it came time to do, after finishing a master's thesis on Samuel Taylor Coleridge and the history of ideas work, I wanted to do something with the contemporary pictures that would have been issued in England at the time of the Romantic poets. And the people in the English department looked at me like I had five heads, and they wouldn't allow it. And you meet these wonderful people in life, and this assistant librarian at the University of Cincinnati called me in and said, you're in the wrong place. And he said, there's a program at George Washington University in American Studies. It's cross-disciplinary. They have an affiliation with the Library of Congress. Go there and try it. So I applied. I got in. And I met this wonderful man at the Prints and Photographs Division at the Library of Congress, a fellow named Milton Kaplan, who is just the most warm and engaging person. He just loved to work with researchers and so on. And it was really Milt's idea that I do this book on the American Revolution in drawings and prints. And the idea was to use the Library of Congress materials to show the pictures that were done during the years of the Revolution. The dates 1765 to 1790 corresponded with the first rumblings over the Stamp Act to 1 year after the Constitution. So it wasn't just pictures of battles, like battle art. It was pictures that was the whole revolution. It was the political, the social, economic, anything to do with the Quebec Act, the religious elements of it, and so on. And I just saw that as a way of showing pictures that would, be very useful in interpreting historical events. And the contemporary pictures are one thing. After the Revolution and into the 19th century, there's lots of pictures of the American Revolution, but these are a romanticized interpretation of the American Revolution. The contemporary pictures were quite down to earth and quite simplistic in a certain way. But Milt and other colleagues, we all agreed that when somebody did a book on the American Revolution, you need to be very particular about it. You just didn't take any old picture of Anthony Wayne. Or you recognized that there were quite a number of important people that never had their pictures made, and so on. And somebody in the 1870s said, oh, it's the centennial of their death, and I'm going to draw an imaginary picture. Well, what's the use of that as opposed to something else? So this is the way I got into it, and I really enjoyed it, loved it, was a rare book librarian, enjoyed sharing these things. Well, when I decided to get into the business of things, I left the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, came to Philadelphia, have never regretted that. What a wonderful place we live in. What a great city. And what wonderful libraries and museums we have here. And it's just made all the difference in making my life happy. So I was once asked by John Dan at the Clements Library to come out to Ann Arbor and give a talk on, what was it like to go from the profession of librarianship into trade. and so on. And I will say that as a rare book librarian, I really enjoyed having students come in and just getting turned on by something, you know, holding a rare book that had once belonged to their favorite author or whatever. And I love doing that. Now I run an establishment where they can come in and they can handle a book or a print or a map, and they can put down some money and take it home with them. But at the same time, in the same line, I'm building museum and library collections. And I stress the fact that it was multiple. If I was a curator again, I would be building one collection. And this time, the whole world is my oyster. So I guess that's the thumbnail sketch.
To pick up on Don's comment, I think the thing that to me is what we do is that we have fun. We're in a fun business. I think, I mean, both what we do, but also I think our shop is a fun place. At least I have a good time, and I know Don has a good time. I don't know about the employees, but we love what we do, and it's a fabulous thing to be able to earn your living doing something you love to do. It really, every day I get up, it's like, oh goody, I get to go to work. I was going to be a philosopher. My dad is a minister, and I was sort of brought up to think that business was really the lowest of the low. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I wasn't going to go into business. I was going to think ethereal thoughts and teach other people to do that. And later on, I'm not from Philadelphia originally. I came here to do my PhD at UPenn. And I'd been in school for a long time because I'd gone to England, done a degree. And so when I had the opportunity to work in the business of something I'd always loved, which was old maps and prints, I thought, oh, great, I'll take a year off. I'll actually earn some money, which my wife thought was a really neat idea. And then I'll do it for a year and then go back. And I just found that after it was just, this is such a cool thing. It's a cool thing because what we deal in are just fabulous things. What Sarah was saying about prints, they're not just illustrations, they're original documents. Prints and maps are something that most of them, and the ones that, I mean, Don talks a little bit about retroactive prints done in the 19th century showing 18th century events, and they're nice, but they're not really tend to be what excites us or most collectors. What's really exciting are contemporary images, and what they are is a contemporary image is somebody expressing their world, their understanding of their world, their environment, and it lets us, by looking at an old print or map, it lets us see through their eyes, and it's not somebody today making a map of this is where this Revolutionary War battle was or this is what happened. It's somebody at the time saying this is what happened today or, you know, last week. And that's a really exciting thing to be able to deal with. And when I first started, you know, having come from sort of a philosophy background, when Don and I decided we were going to go into business, the hardest thing I had to deal with when we first started this was making money. Because we would buy something, and I knew what we paid for it, and then we'd sell to somebody else for more. And it was like I had this little guilt thing, And not only that, but I wanted to sell it to them, and I wanted to make the money. I wanted to take their money and make money. And I really, you get to know people, because it's a fun business, and the people we deal with are people that we share an enthusiasm with. Like the Walls are here, Milton, Joan Wall, somewhere here, who has fabulous there. I had a wonderful collection of Philadelphia prints, and they collected for years. And we were able to work with them to market their prints and put together a catalog. And we had a great time. So, there's this personal connection with people. And here I am, I'm making money while I'm doing this. And I really had this guilt about this. But what finally did it was that I realized that year after year, and we would, when we go to antique shows around the country, we would write people and say, we're coming into town, and, why don't you come to the show? And I thought, I am advertising ourselves, and that's bad. But people would come in, and they come in, oh, I'm so glad you're back. Excuse me. I'm so glad you're back. This is so exciting, you're back. I get to see this stuff, and I bought that last year, and I love it, and I'm so glad. And it finally dawned on me that we're actually giving people the opportunity to have these things. And it's a great thing. So actually, you know, and if we didn't make enough money, we wouldn't do it. Obviously, we couldn't be in business. So I'm actually okay with it now. So if anybody wants to buy something from me, it won't bother me at all. But we have a great time. We have fun. Both Don and I come from academic backgrounds. And one of the nice things about the field that we're in is that there's still a lot of research to be done. When I was in philosophy, one of my frustrations was that to do research, you ended up on this little tiny subject. You know, not only how many angels dance on the head of a pin, but what kind of flowers they have in their hair. You know, I mean, you had to get to some minutia. Whereas we're in a business now where constantly things walk in that nobody's written about. We discover new things all the time. I mean, not regularly, you know, several times a year, something that nobody's written on, nobody's done, or we'll get some prints in that we'll see a connection that nobody's made before. Because this stuff, there's still awful lot of research to be done. And we have the opportunity to see an amazing amount of things. So every day, Don and I have a good time. We get to work with fabulous stuff. We're doing a public service. I mean, you know, what's not to like? So, we're supposed to talk about our favorite prints now? Okay. Don, you can...
Oh, okay. One of the things, we were afraid nobody would ask any questions. So this is filler. But this is an example of what we do. Sarah and company asked Chris and me to pick our favorite graphic. And... explain a little bit why it is. And this is my favorite American historical print, even though I did a lot with the American Revolution, but it's the whole range. This is a print by a man named Francis Carpenter, whose the original painting for this hangs in the United States Capitol. And it shows Lincoln reading the first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet. I gave a full hour talk about this print to the Philo Biblon Club some months ago, or a couple years ago, so I'm going to have to shorten this a bit, I think. But the reason, you know, I think that every little detail in this, as the painting was, says something about Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. And I mean, there's just all these little details. After the talk, if you come up, there's a little picture in the background over here. And it's a portrait of Simon Cameron, who was one of Lincoln's first group of appointees to be in his cabinet. And Simon Cameron was a Pennsylvania politician who was made Secretary of War as Simon Cameron ran his little township in Pennsylvania. He wanted to run the War Department at the beginning of the Civil War out of the hat band of his hat, using little slips of paper and so on, and there was a big mess. Simon Cameron overextended himself, and Abraham Lincoln, in his wisdom, gave Simon Cameron a promotion. He made him the ambassador to Russia and so on. And it's just all these little, you know, we could go into each person of the way they're sitting, whether they were for the Emancipation Proclamation with their, you know, extended hands, or whether they were against the Emancipation Proclamation. But to me, the most important thing about this is it says something, it says so much about Lincoln. And the fact that Lincoln walked into this cabinet meeting, and he didn't say, I've got this paper that I've written about and I want to see what you say. Lincoln said, this is what we are going to do. And to my mind, this is the great turning point in the moral history of the United States of America. We've actually sold about 10 different copies of this, and I'm so happy to have people liking it. I like this so much that this used to be mine, and when the library company bought the building next door and wanted some furnishings, I asked John if could I give you this to hang in there, because I'd like the visiting scholars to have this kind of inspirational print. And fortunately for me, he said yes. So there's this copy. I've bought one since, and I've got another one in my house, and I just love it. But for that reason, there's so much to be said. And one could go on about every little book. There's a map here. It goes on and on. But this is my favorite print, and this is why I do what I do with it.
I had to get something bigger than Don, so I have this, pick this map. This is a John Hills map of Philadelphia. And John Hills was a British surveyor, engineer, who came over in the Revolution and decided to stay on. And at the end of the 18th century, he did a map of basically center city Philadelphia, which what was then the city of Philadelphia. And then he decided in the early 19th century, 1801, he started surveying the areas around Philadelphia. And in 1808, he issued a first edition of this map. And in fact, over here, quite remarkably, the library company has a proof copy. It was issued in 9 sheets. It's a very big map, and those are 2 of the sheets. And that was issued in 1808. Well, actually, that's a proof copy. That may actually come out a little bit earlier. I think March 1808 was the first published date. And what's really interesting, and this is what I was talking about, finding new things. This map, which has been known, and people knew there were various editions of it, but actually there are, and I should have looked at the number, but there's something like 18 or around 20 copies, known copies, and every one but possibly 2 of them are different. They are different because what happened was that, and this is construction, is that as they went along, they would be getting new information from surveys, and he'd work on the copper plates, because there were 9 copper plates to make this. It would take a long time, but they have new information. Somebody would come in and want to buy it. They wanted to add that information, so what they did was they added it by manuscript. And so you would get one map where you might have some new properties up here, and then a few years, you know, maybe a year later, they would actually have engraved that. So then they would publish one with that information engraved. In the meantime, somebody else would come in, and there'd be more information here. And if you come up and look at the early proofs compared to this, you'll see there are a lot of changes. A lot of this particular map, not a huge amount, but a fair bit of this map, is actually done in manuscript. It looks engraved, and this was something, again, that wasn't documented. But if you look very closely, especially some of the names and the properties are actually handwritten in very neatly. They're very similar to the engraved line, so they may have been written in by the person who did the engraving. But every single version is different. And some of them, it's not like it's a constant progress, because sometimes in one area, you might have a couple of the maps have a lot of property information in New Jersey, and then some of them have more property information in West Philadelphia. So it may have been that somebody came in and said, you know, I live there, you know, include more of the property from there. But to discover this and to document them, and I've looked at, I believe, every known copy of this, and I gave a talk, we had a print conference, and I gave a talk in September on this map, and literally, like, 2 weeks before the talk, I found another copy, so I had to scurry off and compare it, and it was different than the other ones. I had these photocopies of each section, because the only way you could tell is you had to look, you know, specifically at every different thing to find out where the differences are. And it's kind of interesting, you have, and I don't remember whether on this map or not, I'll have to look closely, but they have one place where the maps are joined, and originally in one copy, they hand wrote an inscription. When it first came out about a property there. Then they, in the meantime, took this plate and engraved the front half of that inscription, but didn't do the back half yet. So you have a few copies with an engraved beginning of the inscription and a manuscript end. But then they kind of forgot about it. They never engraved it, and they stopped adding the end of the inscription. So you have copies with, you have the beginning of the inscription, you know, it says, you know, John H. and then no last name. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is a lot of fun. It's a great map, but it really, and it still warrants a lot more research. And they have 4 copies, I think. 4 of the 20 copies are here, including the first one. And this is not Historical Society has the most advanced, the latest copy, because they did supposedly four different editions, although each one is different. This is probably the third edition, probably came out about 1814. The last edition, at least the date, is 1860. So it's just a fabulous thing, and it's really worth it if you're, I assume you're all from the Philadelphia area, but come up and look at the detail on it. It's really a fabulous map. And so we've talked long enough now. I think maybe some people have some questions. So we'll turn it over to the audience.
I'm curious about how you got started in the business. What you had, what each of you had, what kind, and I really, you can't give us an inventory, but I'm guessing you didn't have a whole lot, but what did you have, and how did you know that would be enough to generate a, or how did you guess that would be enough to generate a business?
We didn't know for sure. I assure you. Because I did dissertation research over in London and Paris when I was in graduate school, I was able to buy some items and had a few prints and so on. We pooled a few thousand dollars each, opened a shop in Chestnut Hill and wondered if anybody would ever come in the door. And they did. And we started doing some antique shows and so on. And we just bought and sold.
It was actually very scary. Because I gave up going down in philosophy, which of course probably wasn't going to be terribly remunerative, but still, we put all the money we had basically into this, and Don had some inventory, and we just hustled to find stuff and sell it. And when we were first in business, we used to, you know, as we were traveling around, one of us would be going doing something. We'd call the other one if we made a, you know, $200 sale. Oh, we can pay the, you know, the electric bill now. And in fact, when we first went into business, we now own our building, but we were renting. And one of the scariest things was we had to sign a 5-year lease. And we were like, well, what happens if we go out of business in 6 months? You know, we got to pay the lease. And I, to this day, grateful to the landlord. And he said, if you give me 2 months' notice, we'll let you out of the lease. And that gave us the confidence to go ahead. But it was very scary, and it worked out, I guess. 1982. We had just set the conference we had in September was to celebrate our 25th anniversary. So it did work out, yeah. 82.
My question to Don is that the illustration that Doris Kearns Goodwin used on her book of Lincoln and the combativeness of his cabinet? Is that the...
Yes, yeah, that's on the dust jacket.
The dust jacket. When I thought, why is it familiar? Uh-huh. And I don't have the book, but God knows I've heard her on public radio and the bookmarks or whatever it is on... CNN, yeah.
Right.
And I remember seeing it, and I thought, no, you're good. You know, I remember walking into your shop in 1982. I was younger and thinner, and you don't remember. I think we mentioned it. And then I was out of Philadelphia for 5 years. But when I came back, one of the things that I really enjoyed when I was in Chestnut Hill was just casually walking in and just unthinkingly looking at whatever was around, and always your staff was very helpful. And considering that I have that University of Cincinnati background also, but mine was classics and ancient history, I was always looking for something that reflected on, you know, the Rome. It's like, and I seldom saw anything, but I'm glad that I used to just casually enjoy being in your shop, so thank you.
Thank you.
You obviously know this map very well, this one here in front of me. Is there a section there that says McMahon, the famous Philadelphia nurseryman, around the turn of
1800s? I don't know it well enough, but afterwards I think you'd take a good look.
I think near Richmond.
Near Richmond. I don't remember every name, so I can't help you with that one. Yeah. But there are lots of property owners and things. It's a very good map for that.
Don, I was wondering what the significance of the empty chair was.
Yeah. I've never been asked that. Good question. Maybe it's Simon Cameron. Interestingly enough, these chairs are well documented. They were in the cabinet room, and they sometimes appear in American furniture sales, around even to this day. The books were particular books on constitutional law and various precedent-setting decisions that allowed Lincoln to do what he did with the Emancipation Proclamation and with the votes in Congress and things like that. So, I mean, every little detail is something. Now, the fact that it was empty doesn't, as far as I know, refer to anybody. You know, there's like none of them died, so the empty chair at the table or something like that. I've never read anything like that. Carpenter actually wrote a book called, My Time in the White House, where he wrote about doing this painting and things. For instance, there's this one little aspect here. There's a crumpled up paper here on the floor. And Horace Greeley was walking through the White House when Carpenter was working on his canvas. And Horace Greeley, being the editor of the New York Tribune, said, newspapers are very important to the war effort and so on. And he said, you really should have something to do with newspapers. So Carpenter said, okay, sir, he put a newspaper in it and so on. So anyway, but thank you.
Chris, do separate plates exist for each of the sections on the map? Or?
You mean the copper plates? As far as I know, they're not in existence. I've never seen them. But it was, and they, as far as I can tell, it was the same copper plate was used. The updatings were done on the original plate. It does not appear that at any time one of the plates disappeared and then they re-engraved it. But I don't believe they still
have. Proofs like the one that's there, are there multiple?
That's the only one. For each one, as I say, of the ones I found, each one except for two, I don't know for sure those two are identical, but I didn't find any differences. But every other one is unique in terms of the information it has, which is really unusual.
But there are multiple unique proofs?
No, that's the only proof set. That's the only one which has just very basic engraving. And then that was probably issued. My guess would be that would have been something he used to sell the map when he first, came out, that he got it, and he said, look, wouldn't you like to buy this? They're uncut. They're really spectacular to have that.
What about the actual copper engraving, the copper itself?
As far as we know, that they don't exist.
Melted into cannonballs.
If you were going to advise someone who was starting out as a collector, what area of prints would you point them towards, or what areas would you point them towards now?
That's a philosophical question.
I would actually, on that note, actually early on, and still today, we get people coming, what should we buy for investment? And it's been our firm philosophy that you don't buy prints and maps for investment, that is not the reason to buy them. They do go up in value, most of them have, and some probably go up more than others. But you get them because you like them. And what we usually recommend is that you think about what interests you and then buy those. Now, you have to adjust it to some extent because you got to realize, if you're interested in prints of the American Revolution, like the ones that Don's book covers, those tend to be fairly expensive, contemporary views of the American Revolution. So, if you're a college student who doesn't have very much money and you say, gee, I want, American prints of the American Revolution, there are some you can get, some magazine illustrations that aren't that expensive, but you've got to realize you're limited. So you've got to take into account how much money you have to spend. And there's certainly some areas that are underappreciated. 19th century popular lithographs by firms other than Currier and Ives, for instance. Currier and Ives had many competitors who issued wonderful prints, which are much less known and generally sell for less. So, if you're interested in that, we say, well, that's a good area. But really, the real key is the value of prints comes from your appreciation of them, your enjoyment of them. So the number one thing is to think about what you're interested in and then learn about that subject, which is crucial because then what there is out there, and then you buy that. So that's really the advice, not a particular area, but to look inside yourself.
I have a question for both of you as businessmen and map lovers and people that enjoy sharing the maps. And that is, how would you see using the maps in the modern perspective of being able to, with those maps, if a person had access to them, particularly in their small size, you could in an afternoon in a $100 scanner scan those maps and then put them on the internet, and anyone could download the picture and print it on a good quality paper so that you could have a map that would look really identical to what's there. And I wondered what's your feeling about the fact that that can happen now?
That's okay. That's fine. If someone likes the image and you want to hang it up, I mean, we have very sophisticated collectors that also will actually make copies of their original documents and so on, and they hang that in their beach cottage or something, you know, because then they don't worry. But I often think in that my good buddy Bob Peck from the Academy of Natural Sciences often says, people really want a piece of the true cross, you know, and there is a certain thrill in that, and there's fun, and then of course, you know, for research purposes, for the museums and the libraries, sure they want that, not so much that they want to impress their friends, but there's certain something about that original paper, the varieties of the hand coloring that can or not, cannot be on these things, just the differences in the strike. You know, the more you know about the old-fashioned ways of doing engraving and printing from engraving and making paper and so on, that's where our interest in market is, and we never get into reproductions because that's for somebody else to do and so on.
Yeah, there is. There is a real role for that, and in fact, more and more libraries are actually going to digital images for study. So if you go in, you actually generally don't see the original object. You see a digital image or a facsimile. And that's fine because, you know, these are rare items, and if you're interested in the information, you can learn a lot from that. And I agree with Don. It's a totally different thing, and that's we stay out of that. I mean, we're interested in the artifacts and the fact that these were used. But one thing that a bugaboo of mine is that there is a tendency or a trend now of companies to make these very elaborate facsimiles. And a facsimile differs from a copy in that a facsimile is as close to the original as possible in terms of size and supposedly quality of things, even though it's not an original. And this happens particularly with things like Audubon's and some early natural history prints. And there is a role for that because they are, some of them are beautiful. Some of these Audubon facsimiles are just gorgeous. And, you know, if you want to decorate your house with large folio Audubon's and you don't have the money to buy the originals, it gives you something to do that looks good and has quality. And there's a role for that. What upsets me, though, is that there are many firms who are pushing these as collectibles. And they're saying these are special, you know, that you should pay a premium for these. And my attitude is that if somebody's selling a facsimile, a company is making and selling a facsimile, they need to make a profit, or they're not going to, like us, you know, we have to make a profit, we wouldn't be in business. Well, they wouldn't do it if they're not making money. And that's fine. And you should be willing, if that's what you want, to pay a fair price to make a really good quality. But to add on value, because in some sense these are collectibles, and I won't use any names, but there are a number of firms doing this now, you know, that these are taken from this particular collection, you know, or this, you know, they're like this and they're special. The thing is that anything, the difference between an original and a copy is an original is unique. It you can't make it again. It's there, I mean, however many there are, and that's it. A facsimile, anybody else can make a facsimile that has as much legitimacy. And this has happened with Audubon's, that there were a number of early facsimiles done in the earlier 20th century. And they went up and up in price because people could get them. And they were saying, oh, these are really rare. We got to buy them. And people were spending literally thousands of dollars on these. Well, then another firm came out with a whole another group that were just as good, if not better. And all of a sudden, the price dropped down because they're no better than the new ones. And then that happens again. So, you know, with facsimiles, pay what they're worth for the quality, but don't buy into this stuff about that they're, you know, they're limited number of them or they're taken from this or that. They're facsimiles. And as long as you treat them and know what they are and appreciate them for what they are, that's fine. But if you try to make them something else, they're not. That's my sermon.
Where do you actually find new examples of this old stuff for your store? And has anyone ever tried to sell you a fake?
Well, the second part is that people bring us things to sell us all the time, and some are fakes, but it's our job to know what's original and what is not. And I can't think of anybody that's actually tried to, oh, I'm going to pull the wool over these guys' eyes or something like that. It's more that they don't know. Now, as to where we get things, everywhere. I mean, it's just amazing. People call us on the phone. They walk in the front door of our shop. We sometimes trade things with other dealers. We look at the auction houses. Sometimes something at auction sells for more than what we would sell it for. Sometimes something drops for a lower price, and we can buy it, that we feel we can resell at a fair market value, and so on. And it just goes on and on.
Actually, one of the the Antiques Roadshow has been a lot of fun. Both of us enjoy it. If we didn't enjoy it, we wouldn't still do it. But the greatest benefit for that has not been in selling, it's been in buying. It helps a little bit to sell, you know, if you were in an antique show somewhere and somebody comes in and they're looking at an Audubon or something, and they've seen us on the roadshow, they feel at least the confidence that we probably know what we're doing. But that's kind of small. What's really important is buying, because there is a surprising amount of really good stuff still out there in attics. And a lot of these people have things, they don't know what to do with it. And when we'll appear on the roadshow, the next day we'll get 30, 40 emails, 30 or 40 phone calls. And that's really why we have staff, so they can answer the phone calls. We don't have to. But every once in a while, most of it is, you know, not very good things. But every once in a while, something really great. Somebody in Wichita, you know, oh, I got one of these in my attic. Are you interested? And they walk in the door. I mean, it's amazing. Just as an example, the Philadelphia Antique Show is coming up next week. Yeah, I guess next week, Friday, is a preview. And we're going to have one of the greatest maps we've ever had for sale there. The Nicholas Skull 1756, I think, map of Pennsylvania. Incredibly rare map of Pennsylvania. A guy just walked in the door with it. Are you interested in this, he said. And we're like, oh, yeah. He just walked in the door. He got it out of a house somewhere. He had no idea what it was worth. And he was absolutely floored. And it just walked in the door. So, I mean, it's that's part of the fun of this business.
What's the mental process you go through when you look at it and authenticate it? What is the serial set of thoughts you have when they walk in the door and you see that for the first time or something you've never seen before? How do you mentally iterate through it in your mind to say it's a real thing or not?
Well, first of all, you document it. You say, you know, this is an original document. It's not a reproduction or something like that. That's an important aspect of it. What you might be asking about is what you pay for it.
No. I don't know if it's real or isn't.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, having handled old documents and old books and old everything, you know, just partly the feel of the paper. You hold the paper up, you see the wire lines and chain lines. You look for a watermark. You look at a magnifying glass, and you can tell whether it's a line engraving or an etching, or is it various graphic processes. We've worked with these graphic processes. We can often tell by looking at it, especially under magnification, what kind of printing process was used. If it says 1790, and it's a lithograph. You know, lithography wasn't invented till 1800 or 1799, and so on, and that sort of thing.
Also, one of the things, we're kind of lucky. If you look at manuscripts, they are valuable enough, some manuscripts, and that people have faked them. I mean, there was the Mormon, you know, manuscripts that were faked, and the Hitler diary and that kind of thing. With our stuff, there really isn't, there hasn't been an industry of making really good fakes. I mean, in Italy, they're constantly running these things off, and they put on fake plate marks, and they use fake hand-laid paper. But it's obvious to anybody who's dealt with this stuff, you know, as soon as you see it, you know, an expert, you know. So in a way, there's not as much concern that we don't have to test the paper. I mean, we have to do the basic checks of paper and process and that kind of thing. But it's pretty standard. So that's really not a huge issue with us. I mean, if it's behind glass, a lot of times, and we have bought fakes before because they're behind glass and you can't tell. And sometimes you, like in an auction or, you know, in a shop, you don't have the opportunity to take it out. But the authenticity of the stuff we're looking at isn't that big an issue.
Is it all being collected somewhere?
Does our shop have an archive?
Or does your new discovery get contributed to the collective archive?
I guess no more or less than anybody else's. We do keep records of things. For instance, I guess my library background, I started a small vertical file, and now it's, you know, five steel drawers filled with all these files on various people. Plus, we have a huge reference collection. Our reference books where we find something new to add to a reference thing, we'll pencil in a little bit of information about it. That may seem a very bad thing to do to write in a book, but you know the old time librarians did that, and I always appreciated that. You come across something and. So in that way, you know, we're building a certain database of sorts, and also just our computer files on this, you know, documentary descriptions and things like that. That's there. And someday when we're dust, some library will maybe own them or something. You know.
But there is no central listing of many things. I mean, Courier and Eyes prints. They're over. Probably almost 8,000 prints listed now, and the American Historical Print Collectors Society actually has a list which they're trying to collate of previously unrecorded Courier and Eyes. So there's a place, if we get one, we send the information to them. Generally, there isn't. There's a tendency, because obviously we love publicity, so if we get something really unusual, we try to publicize it. We'll maybe write an article in the American Historical Print Collector Society or something else. So we're trying to document, but there's no, especially like Philadelphia prints, there is no, I mean, they're the standard books, but there is no standard, database that lists them all.
But it might be great to collect the records when you do find something new in one repository and possibly even a scan.
Well, when you get this going, let us know. We'll send you all the things.
As a sort of follow-on to that, I wonder if you could comment on how the Internet has affected your business in particular and the exchange of information.
It's the Internet has been fundamental to our shop. We do about 25% of our business now over the Internet in terms of just straight sales, but there's a lot more that people find us. One of the great things about the Internet, we were very early. I'm a bit of a computer geek and got interested in the Internet very early on. We had one of the first shops on the Internet, I don't remember how many years ago, but a good number of years ago. And everybody thought then you had to have a storefront, you know, and in fact somebody approached us and said, we want to be in a web mall. And it would have stores, and you'd go in the front door, your front page, and then you'd go. But nobody does that. As you know, the way people find things now is they type it into Google or another thing, and they go directly to your page. So you don't have one door. We have something like 700 pages on our website. And what's great about that, and what I think has really helped us, and especially, I mean, Don and I, because we love prints, we buy anything that's quality print. Doesn't matter whether we think we can sell it. We've had two copies of this big, huge print of Andersonville Prison, which is really grotesque with all these people dying and getting buried. And, you know, the first time...
Gruesome.
And when we first bought it, we were like, you know, we'll never sell this, but it's a great print. We'll buy it. We sold it. And then like 3 months later, somebody else bought one, and we're like, oh, we were so lucky the first time, but we bought it. And, you know, so we buy a lot of stuff. Well, now on the Internet, we can put up these lists of obscure stuff that, you know, in a million years, somebody wouldn't walk into our shop. And somebody says, oh, my great-grandfather was so-and-so. I wonder whether there's a print of him. They type in his name, and our page comes up. Or they type in their little town they came from. And a little view that you could have sat for 50 years will come up. And we're selling all over the world that way. So it's really been great in terms of selling nice prints but obscure things.
Don, getting back to your original picture over there, my wife is a little shy. She thinks that those empty chairs... Oh, is it one empty chair? Well, there's a gentleman. There are two gentlemen in the back, and it looks like some... Whoever was painting this asked them to please get up and face us so that he could. I mean, that's pretty.
Oh, okay.
To stand up, especially the gentleman with his arms folded across his chest, to make his presence more pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been his chair.
Yep. Okay, that's true. Realism.
Now,
very important thing.
Now, I have a question.
No, you and Jerry only get one question.
Well, she was your neighbor. Now I'm a stranger. My question is this. I've been reading about the Battle of Italy during the Second World War. And the thing that amazes me, having been a young man during that period of time, I knew nothing about it. Nothing. Zero. I was in the Navy. I didn't know anything about it. But one of the things that I'm reading, which I find fascinating, excerpts that the author has made from the diaries of the various people that were in the Battle of Italy. And I just wonder if there are diaries of these men that have been studied to give their reaction to this very fantastic meeting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Actually, that was very much what Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals, was all about. She went into quite a study of each of those men and what they were doing. You know, the fact that, first of all, Lincoln took all of his political rivals and put them on the cabinet because each had their own sphere of influence and had a certain amount of power, and so you bring all this power together. But then he had to manage them and so on. And he talked about each man, she went into the archives, into the papers of each of those men and their families and so on. And, for instance, Secretary of the Treasury Chase had a beautiful young daughter who was quite a power in Washington on the social level and so on, and was quite a competitor of Mary Todd Lincoln. It's also one of my favorite books. I have to say, though, I gave my lectures on this before the book came out. I didn't crib the book.
All right, I'm sorry to say we have time only for one more question, and so I'm going to have to...
Oh, Jay Stiefel, yay, oh, good.
Hey, we're on a podcast, Don. Don't get that excited. Well, I guess I ought to bring things full circle. I was interested by your little story about how you became interested in gravures and prints as a child. And we all know how appalling the lack of knowledge is amongst current school children, history and geography and that sort of thing. And I was wondering whether you've ever participated in any programs with youth to introduce them to this sort of visual material, or know of any other programs that have been effective in conveying history to them through these images?
There actually are some programs. There's a lot more. One of the changes in history in the last several decades has been more of an emphasis on using contemporary illustrations for history rather than the old history books would have somebody draw pictures, or they might use a 19th century engraving of 18th century. And there are more and more books focusing on contemporary images. And there are some programs that are being done, and the, I think it's the Newberry Library has a program on using maps to educate children. And I've actually given a talk to children a number of times on myths on maps. And it's kind of fun because I love myths on maps. You know, they're mistakes, and that always seems to interest especially kids. But I will say that the thing that's the most popular is that is the myth of El Dorado. El Dorado was a place that appears on a map. It was a mythical place, obviously, and it moved across South America, started up in Colombia, and ended up in Guyana. And it ended up supposedly up in these highlands of Guyana on a big lake, which didn't exist either. And Sir Walter Raleigh, actually, one of his captains, captured a Spanish ship which had a map, because the Spaniards had been looking for this for a century, basically. And they captured the map from the governor who owned the territory, or was ruled the territory, and had been looking for El Dorado, and here was El Dorado on the map. And so Sir Walter Raleigh thought, great, you know, the riches. And in the meantime, Elizabeth dies. Sir Walter Raleigh is thrown into prison by James, who doesn't like him. And, you know, James wants to get rid of him. And Sir Walter Raleigh finally comes to him and he says, well, gee, you know, let me out. I'll go get El Dorado for you. You know, get all the gold. Well, James was, like, making up, he was Catholic, he was making up to the Spanish king, and so, you know, there was a little problem because the Spanish claimed that, but James also liked gold, so he kind of said to Sir Walter Raleigh, okay, you can go do this, but just don't get into any fights with the Spanish, which is, of course, ridiculous because he's going to their country. So, anyway, Sir Walter Raleigh goes over, captures the governor, goes looking for this, ends up fighting, his son is killed, they of course don't find it because it doesn't exist, comes back and, oh my God, you know, we had these problems, my son is dead, we didn't find it, and James says, great, off with his head. And that is actually why Sir Walter Raleigh lost his head, was because he was looking for El Dorado. Well, of course, at the end of my talk on this, that's all anybody wants to know about, Sir Walter Raleigh losing his head. So, you know, you know, it depends on how, you know, what age group. But I think people enjoy, and kids enjoy these old maps, and I think there is a trend toward that.
We sell books at our shop about, you know, reference books for adults, but there's also some very nice children's books. And we sell those too, you know, the Young Companions, Reader for Maps, and there's various things like that. I guess we just haven't done a lot of, you know, children's groups or so. I've had at some antique shows, they bring grade school groups through, and if they bring a bunch of little kids through, I'll say, oh, sit around and I'll show you these pictures of George Washington and so on, and a bit of that.
Thanks.